Hello and welcome to this podcast from Blackwell Online. My name is George Miller, and my guest today is Penn Vogler, who by day works for Penguin as a publicist, but by night, so to speak, has edited a wonderful series called Penguin Great Food, 20 short, beautifully designed books by food writers through the ages, from Mrs. Beaton, Hannah Glass, Charles Lamb and Bria Savarin, to Elizabeth David, Claudia Roden and Alice Waters, as well as some less familiar names, as you'll hear. The first thing I wanted to know when I met Penn was where the idea for the series had come from.
Well, it was a very big long gestation, really, because I used to work for the British Museum, and they published a lot of books on food history, so that's where the interest first came in. And at Penguin, they produced this fantastic series, which most people know for great ideas, and I took some time off work, mostly to read cookie books in the British Library. These old cookie books, and I thought they would make a fantastic Great Ideas series because there's so much in them, so much cultural history, lots of fantastic writing, and recipes as well.
So, did you have a set of criteria for the ideal candidate for this series when you first met?
I did. There had to be a voice. You had to felt that you were cooking with somebody, or they were kind of cooking with you. So there are some wonderful, very famous French chefs, for example, who's, you know, Terry, whose recipes are very, very famous in their books, are used by everybody, even today. But they don't have something that they're talking to us about. They didn't kind of come in. So I felt you had to learn something about the person, and something about the food that was coming through what they were telling you. And that was really the only criteria.
So how far back did you decide to go? What's your earliest?
The earliest one is Gervis Markham and his book, The Complete Housewife, which was in 1615. There are earlier cookery books, obviously. The earliest in English is the form of curry, C-U-R-Y, which I think is in the 13th or 14th century, but they're not really sort of followed, but you can't really follow the recipes, and there's not much voice, as I say. So Gervis Markham is wonderful because he's a, it's rather like seeing inside the kitchens of Henry Montel's Wolf Hall, so much that period. And you get a lovely sense of him and what life was like at the time for a housewife or somebody cooking at the time. But it's just in pretty distant from that, actually. A lot of the words he uses is somewhere, and you have to go and research to find out what he used by nugget, for example.
I opened this book at random and said to make jumble. It's a marvellous, almost a Lewis Carroll kind of thing. But on the facing page, it says to make dinner jumble. Even more terrific. So, yes, there's all these words that are taken, and you have to almost like decode and try to work out what jumble is like. And I'd like to do some examples of that in the middle of the range.
It's a biscuit, really shaped in a sort of different way. Jumble is not biscuit. Sort of shape that together. Yeah, so lots of work, and the housewife at the time had to do so much, so many different things. She not only had to be a cook, she had to make recipes and remedies, she had to know how to brew, how to make, she had to know how to preserve and make wine. So there are wonderful instructions for things like, you know, how to stop bastards being eager. And bastard is some kind of preserved wine, I don't even know quite what. And eager means, I think, it, you know, goes a bit too sharp. So, yes, there's a huge wide range of things that housewives needed to do. A lot of those things we don't need to do now, and also a lot of the words of vocabulary we never come across now.
What you want to do, I suppose, is to capture some of that strangeness, not to make a selection of recipes that would go back in the modern kitchen, but actually to show how things have changed, how different things are.
Definitely how different things are. But I think what also the series does is it shows you the kind of ancestors of food that you do eat today. It shows you where things originate from. So, for example, I had a very interesting experience. I had a great chef called Andrew Turner who cooked at Wilton's in German Street, which was an 18th century restaurant. In the 18th century. He made some of the food from, for example, William Verrill, whose cookbook is 1759. Verrill was a publican in Lewis in Sussex. And he made a thing called water sushi, which I think now is a sort of, a Belgian equivalent in terms of this, it's a soup, it's a white, thick fish soup. And we don't have it anymore. That's more kind of creamy fish soup with them, you know, with eel and small fish. And Andy said, you know, I think this is turned into fish pie. It's like creamy, you know, creamy fish with potato and all the rest of it. And now we've decided to just fish pie. So you can see a lot of how recipes originated. And some of them you can cook today.
Well, that's going to lead me on to the obvious question. Did you try some, many, all of the recipes in the offers that you wanted?
Yeah, I've been cooking quite a lot from them. I have a blog, actually. You know, I've been trying to cook something every week and write about it every week. So, and I did it totally at London. And so I've been making cakes and savory dishes and from anything from Elizabeth David to something from, you know, Hardy's in the mid-18th century. There's varying degrees of success. There are lots of challenges.
What are your highs and lows? What sort of things are you really good at?
Well, I think one of my favourite cookbooks is Eliza Acton, the book Easy Cookery was published in 1845. And I was reflecting on the elegance of kindness because she does write very, very elegant recipes and she clearly cooks everything herself. And so she says to you, if you, you know, when you're cooking this cake together, you melt the butter, not don't melt it too hot because then the cake will be heavy. And so she talks you through the recipe, tells you what to do and tells you where to do it. And so you have absolute faith and absolute confidence in how it will turn out well. And they all have. So I've made it with a little bit of ginger bread, which has a lovely different taste of ginger and lemon and cloves. And it does work. It's put together in a very, very different way to a modern cake. It's not sort of, there's no creamy method or rubbing in or anything. It's just sort of put together for your bit. But it comes out, it works. So that was my, probably that's probably the part I like to do the most.
Did you try to make an impact on that book called The Hare and the Porpoise, to which you told me how to cut the hare, how to prepare the pork, how to get the tartar? You didn't invent some of those terrains?
That's kind of dark, actually. That is, no, we haven't. I haven't yet got the hare, not from the hotel. I don't have a love hare, so I'm not sure I've got that one to go on. I haven't done that. Put a quarter on his back, put a little red hand, and, you know, head waving in the air. I'm never going to do that. But I would make jokes with her, and I hope her recipe was influenced by Famous. And, you know, famously, she's supposed to have written for a special hair, only it's so funny that she doesn't, the phrase doesn't appear in that book anymore. So, no, I haven't done anything really weird. And actually, when I'm trying to plan something, if it could be fantastic this time, looking at the recipe at the time, I found that actually it would be nice. And there is feasible to create that you can get the ingredients and rather than actually appear at the end of it.
And one thing that's interesting is that compared to contemporary cookery books, where the missing ingredient is denoted 10 years of development on the method, and then run on to 2 or 3 pages and only 2 weeks of expense. The barrier of expenses, you really have to kind of know what you're about. Often there are no posters given, and the instructions are really quite clear. So presumably they would really have to put a lot of these things that they're taking for granted and understood what they're doing.
I think absolutely, and you get a sense from later cookery writers that they are just a kind of blast of the beaten. They're slightly despairing, but they always think there's a whole generation of people coming up behind them who can't cook and don't know how to cook, because earlier cookery writers, I think probably most of the recipes, they assumed to have been handed down, they assumed to, some of them were looking for professional chefs, but some of them were handed down, they made them more what they think they are, some of them were looking for half lives. But who would have, you know, would have had a good time grounding in how to work. But in earlier recipes, they don't pull the ingredients out and list it. And they don't do it, like you say, they don't do it. They've got big weights and measures, but they're a bit rough. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. Obviously, there's no guessing the size, there's no 200 degrees in the pan. You just have to guess those things. And your idea is you could have taken a different recipe and And I've got some gingerbread as well. You know, if Mandela's gingerbread is the best not for them, and the ones I can do the
Now, most people are impressed that these are books and recipes exclusively. It's worth mentioning that a lot of it is working about the pleasures of food and the quality of food. None of very central work, and I think it really came across as hard, the latest thing, like the vote, the pleasure of the
Yes, absolutely. And I think two of my kind of contrasting favourites are the people who just write about food, who we know are great writers, but not good people of food writers, are Samuel Pepys and Charles Lamb. And Samuel Pepys writes actually all the time in his diaries. He doesn't completely doesn't expect to be that with any part of the population, but he's always telling his what he's had for dinner, how much he had to drink, how much he has to eat, and how ill he feels the next day. And we told our collection his, you know, his diary, The Joys of Excess, because that's what he does. So he thinks he's got some terrible disease, and then the next day he's adopted, and that's just going to be a bunch of the night before. And Charles Lamb is a wonderful contrast to him, because Charles Lamb, obviously, later Victorian, was famously a bachelor, but writes very evocatively, very sensitively, and has this real kind of bachelorish hunger and senselessness. Of food, you could have, you know, you've seen roast beef at the dinner party, being with this kind of persona essay, and not wanting to admire the hostess and children all talking about politics or something, but just wanting to eat, roast mutton, or, you know, something from roast. And he's always, he talks about hunger in a way that most people don't. And actually, fish is an interesting comparison. She should be better known in this country. I hope we might have helped a bit. For that, she was a mid-century American writer. He writes rather like Elizabeth Davis in the way that she sort of modernized food for that one nation, but she writes so beautifully about food and love. And she says, if you can't talk about food with your husband, for example, you can't talk about the most important things, you know, you can't talk about making children or making each other happy. Talking about food, loving food together, sharing food, is really an essential part of the relationship. I love the way she likes to
do it. I also don't think she likes to do it. It's interesting. I mean, we also have to confess to the bites of gluttony. I suppose in earlier centuries, maybe when you had years that were lean years, and you did come from Thailand, and it was kind of the real pleasure of living.
We all overindulge. I think that's probably not changed very much. One of the things that strikes me is how the food writers are very honest about the effect of food on the body, in the way we're not quite in general very interested in how food is healthy for us and good for us, and, you know, obviously cheese or superfoods and all the rest of it. But there's a wonderful Italian musician, Pellegrino Artusi, whose book is used in most of the Italian households, rather like obviously beef muscles until the mid-century maybe. He called cabbage the godfather of wind. You know, he called it aeolus, actually. He says it's, you know, it's the god of wind or something. And he's very honest about those things being to you, and that they're cooked again. He's very honest about how
there's also ways in which the sort of sensuality almost goes into sort of erotic history, isn't it? And there's a really attractive by P.S. Eleanor about the gourmand, and he describes a female gourmand, and he describes her as sort of partially being in her mouth, and it's kind of very erotic, really. I mean, if you're
absolutely, and Riot Seven talks about cattle as well in the same way. And he says, you know, I didn't really know if they're masters, is that? But the people talk to you, they awaken memories in the creative sex that happy memories. So he's very knowing with Seven, you know, he associates, he never say in his food makes you feel, you know, erotic or something, but he knows what the associations are, he knows how important our memories are, and the experiences, you know, your first social experience in the eating together. I think that's one of the lovely things about how a lot of experience is how people are interested in the communion experience of food. I mean, erotically, yes, but you know, that's how fun. But also, that's how important it kind of is in bringing people together.
Now, we've talked about some of the well known names in the history of the show. But one of the attractive issues I thought was introducing little known and unknown names to the people. So, maybe there are some of the less familiar people that you want to think of in the economy.
When I first started reading about on Freedom or Rescue books, I was mostly looking at Britain. And when I decided to do them for series at Penguin, we thought we should make it much more international. So we looked at something that Paul seems to say, which I'm really pleased with actually, because this is something that nearly everybody says they've never heard of, is the Rossity Collector in Michigan in the late 1970s, with Dr. Chase. And he doesn't, he's not a great writer, he's done a lot of different books, and he's probably a great writer. But he has a fantastic ability and an interest in collecting messages from the people who saw, but also in kind of magazines. And he puts on him an astonishing picture of a little birdie and a little pride in their food. Because all early American cookbooks are British cookbooks. And the first American cookbook, I think, wasn't published until and he has a wonderful expression in his particular case, and some of the famous papers in Mr. King. And he says, I don't want government, I say it's good enough for American citizens. And so you can see his sort of patriotism through his recipes. So I was very pleased to have him in this series. Another two, which are not that well known, but I think are historically very interesting. Colonel Wyvern, who was a teacher, who was a colonel in the Raj in British India, who put him in charge of how to cook and put on some French style dinner parties. But also saying to him, don't forget to eat curry. Curry is really nice, honestly. And, you know, your Indian cooks, you know how to make it tasty. Another person saying to him, the Lectus Squire, who was a bit like the Jimmy Oliver, really, of Victorian England, who was a chef at the Revolt Reforming Party, a flamboyant London figure, and he took himself off to the Crimea to teach and cook their house of food, soldiers, both in the hospitals and the museums, properly, because he realized it had to be a nutrition requirement. So he was quite an important character. But, so, yes, those are people who are supposed to start being less well known.
I'm telling you, not to forget, a new name to me is Calvin Pelham. I really loved his writing, American writing, like a Latin son. He just put things on bagels and he wrote pretty well. It's great and very funny.
Yeah, Calvin Pelham is a wonderful writer and very bouncy and very joyous. And I suppose, probably unique in that series, but it's good series. He just wants to write about bagels or, ribs or wontons. He wants to write about the things that people in America like to eat. And we get a lovely portrait of him, his family, his friends, his barbecues, the local restaurants, through his writing.
No, I'm going to make a confession, and I hope you might move on in the time. I am not an admirer of this period. I understand paper and a certain tone, and I can admit that there's a knowledge of importance and a lot of revolutions we have brought about in English speaking. But he just doesn't do it for me. Are there any great information that he didn't do it for me? He just, nonetheless, don't fit with you. We talk about this in the sense of the measure and the commonality.
Well, the person who terrifies me is Mrs. Beeson, because her book opens something like, Exodus, which is a 200-year-old heritage of the mistress of our house. And you automatically start reading it, you pick up a bit straight up. And she tells you, how to drink baths, she tells you people to come up to see your friends, and what to gossip. She tells you to keep the distance between the mistress of the house and her, and perhaps she's very, very interested in, absolutely to come up with, as well as cooking. Yes, she's obviously innovative and she introduced cooking ingredients that the country was the first person to do that. But she wasn't particularly a cook. Her husband was a professional assistant cooking together. And I know she's very important to book and very important to see her series as the campaign for domestic happiness. But she's scarce like me. And if somebody said the other day, well, she did the same thing to me.
Penn Vogler. All 20 of the books in the Penguin Great Food series are available in paperback, and coming this November is a box set containing the entire collection. You can find out more about all the Great Food books, plus several million others, by visiting Blackwell online at blackwell.co.uk. You'll also find a podcast archive there with over 150 author interviews by clicking on the podcast tab on the home page. And if you Google Penn's Great Food Club, you'll find Penn's blog, which she mentioned in the interview. There you can see the results of her attempts to cook some of the recipes in the books. That's all for this edition of the Blackwell Online podcast, but I hope you'll join me again soon for another program. And until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.